The Higher Education Experience. Welcome, Stephen.
Thanks. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. It's interesting, I'm looking at the back of my head. Oh yeah, that was fun. So basically the clickers, yes, there we go. So my objective today, and please excuse me for speaking in English, although I'm told all of you speak English very well. So I feel comfortable doing that. The objective I have today is twofold. First of all, I'm going to really scare you. And secondly, I'm going to give you hope. But I'm going to scare you first, because that's more fun. So, I want to begin by talking about what we're already doing. And what we're already doing is adapting to technology, adapting to the new reality that has become a part of our workplace over the last 20, 25 years. We've entered the technological era of learning. We're using digital tools such as learning management systems and other kinds of systems, Moodle, Desire to Learn, Blackboard, etc. We're using digital learning resources and ebooks, and not just those, videos, audio, I'm recording audio right now, making another learning resource, games, designs, animations, everything you can think of. And we're participating, even in this room, we're participating in online discussions, conferencing, the Facebook chat, right, the Twitter messages going by, and the interactive survey took me 10 minutes to figure out, I'm old, etc. Not only that, we've embraced the new era of pedagogy, 21st century learning. We don't believe anymore that to teach is to stand up on a stage and tell people about things. I know I'm doing that right now, but I'm not trying to make you learn the stuff that I'm thinking. I'm trying to scare you. I'll get to that. We are employing active learning methodologies, posing problems, finding problems, problem-based learning, project-based learning, following people like David Merrill, David Johnson, active hands-on learning that we know works and that we know engages students. We create challenges for our students, and as much as possible, we allow students to take control of their own learning, whether it's through service learning, through entrepreneurship, forming their own business, solving environmental problems, doing monitoring, student journalism, all kinds of things. Uh-oh, it didn't mean to do that. But even so, you know, it's one of these things we think, oh yeah, I finally got it, finally caught up, finally know what this is all about. Learning is changing on us again. Let's think about it. Think about how we're using these technologies and these pedagogies now. Our education system still resembles the traditional education system. But across the board, aspects of this traditional system are being challenged. We'll talk about a few. Previously, even to a large degree to this day, we've been focused on traditional courses, traditional programs. The student goes to school to study engineering, or psychology, or philosophy. But, you know, there's some changes just around the edges of that, right? A lot of schools, a lot of institutions are looking at micro-credentials, badges, competencies. This is certainly a growing trend in the business community. But not just that, we're looking at things that go beyond courses, beyond programs. We talk about 21st century literacies, things like collaboration skills, critical thinking, and the like. So we're moving away from traditional courses and programs. I will have to stop hitting that button. It used to be, and it still is the case to a large degree, that every student gets the same learning. We hear about that with standardized tests, especially at the lower school levels, but even at the college and university level, we're looking at curricular outcomes and minimum standards and all of that. But again, we're beginning to see the change happening. We're beginning to see personalized learning and personal learning. I have a chart there that draws the distinction, but personalized learning is basically us changing the way we teach and deliver instruction to adapt to the needs of the learner. And personal learning is us providing the mechanisms and support so that a person can design and manage their own learning. Sounds a lot like what we used to. The old institutional silos still remain. Education is still based on educational institutions like this one. I know you're all over Mexico, but it's still an institution, right? It's still one place where people go. In Canada, we have issues regarding what we call articulation. And what that is taking credit for a course taught at one institution and applying it to a degree offered at another institution. That should be easy, but it's hard. Even worse, credentials that are issued in one country, things like medical degrees, law degrees, whatever, are not accepted, simply not accepted in another country, which is why in Canada we have taxi drivers who are qualified doctors. It's crazy. Things are changing, beginning to change. And there's a push, you know, it's kind of pushing us towards having credentials that can go anywhere. It's pushing us toward having credentials that are the same in one institution or another institution. That's the point of the Bologna process in Europe. It's pushing us toward an idea of learning where the student is not locked into a single institution. What will you do when your students can leave your institution, go down the street, and finish up their degree at a competitor, no problem? We have not, really at all, advanced significantly in assessment. To a large degree, we assess students by giving them tests. Most colleges and most universities, if I go onto their campus in April, there's students taking exams. Oh yeah, there's still some practical tests. You know, if you're doing an apprenticeship or if you're doing a trade or if you're a professional, like a doctor or a lawyer, there's going to be articulating, hands-on, but it's still based on the test. It's still based on you have to do a special performance. But you know, again, there's changes in the wind. There's growing dissatisfaction with tests. In the United States, they use their SAT test to evaluate applicants for college and university, but some colleges and universities are saying, oh, we don't want these anymore, they're useless, they're not accurate, they don't tell us anything. And as well, we're looking at ways of recognizing learning that happen outside the college or outside the university, a way for somebody to take their practical experience and get recognition for that. Now, right now, that exists. You know, I'm sure you're all familiar with it. Canada, it's called Prior Learning Assessment and Recognition, PLAR, or sometimes called Recognition of Prior Learning, because we can never do things the same way in Canada, coast to coast. But it's hard, it's complex, it takes a lot of time, it's almost as expensive as just teaching the course. But you know, what happens if this gets easy? What happens if we can recognize learning and give people a credential without even teaching them? Something to think about. So those are some of the changes around the edges of the existing system. But you know, our technological landscape is changing too. Again, you probably figure, finally, I've mastered the new technology, and I'm an adult, not a digital native. I have a computer. I have a phone. I can actually make my phone talk to my computer. Hey, I can send email. I know how to do attachments. These were big issues when I was younger. But now that we think we finally understand technology, the entire landscape is about to change. It's all changing again. I'm very sorry. It's happening now. Here are just a few things that I've been observing that are really interesting things. Things you might know about, things you might not know about, things that might impact you in ways you don't expect. One of them is machine learning and artificial intelligence. You probably know about this. Only a few of you will be experts in this, and very few of you will know how to apply machine learning and artificial intelligence in an educational setting. This time, 10 years from now, you'll all need to know that. It'll be part of the discipline. You know, it's not simply for adaptive learning. Remember I talked about personalization a few minutes ago. Personalization, using artificial intelligence to pick resources and show them to people, to adapt the delivery of learning to somebody. No, it's not. That's thinking in the old way. That's thinking of education as the presentation of content to people. No. Artificial intelligence and adaptive learning, we should think of it as the entire environment around us. A simple example, some guy is running that camera. That camera should be following me. It should be following me by itself, thinking for itself. It's such. That's just a simple example. I should have instructions on how to use this in this, and not have to have somebody explain it to an adult. It's a four-button device, but I still managed to get it wrong. The real future in artificial intelligence and analytics, in my mind, is what they call the quantified self. The quantified self, the idea of this is you have technology, like your mobile phone, or like sensors, or like a Fitbit, or something like that, that monitors what you're doing. My phone monitors my location at all times. I always know where I am. I could, if I wanted, but I'm afraid to, have a Fitbit that monitors my blood pressure and my heart rate, when I'm gonna die, a little countdown clock. Okay, maybe not that. I could also have devices that monitor my work, How many lines of code do I write? How many people read my articles? How many people in this audience are actually listening to me right now? How many are doing their email or on Twitter? I could know that right now. This guy brought me here, he's doing something else. It'd be right here, right? It'd be right here. Audience attendance, or audience attention, 23%. A little red light. Do something, do something. Catch their attention. Make them do the wave. Right? So imagine all of these kinds of things working together to give me the best possible suggestion. I like that feedback. That was good. That was analog, how do I want to say it? The quantified analog self. Yeah. Alright. Here's another one. Maybe you know about this. Handheld mobile computer. Hands up. How many of you have a smartphone, mobile phone? Yeah. Okay, and the rest of you are lying. Right. But handheld and mobile computing, what we have right now is only the beginning. Now, I feel like a genius sometimes because back in 2001, I made a prediction about a fishing rod. And it was a fishing rod that would teach you how to fish. It was very simple. You cast your line into the water, and your fishing rod would speak to you and it would say, you've never fished before, have you? Because it knows that that was a really terrible cast. And then it, along with your phone sitting in your pocket, would together start teaching you how to fish. Now that was fiction. I just made that up. I sort of patented it. On the screen there, there's a tennis racket that actually does this. It works with your mobile phone. You play tennis. It gives you feedback about how well you're playing tennis, and then the tennis racket and your phone proceed to help you learn tennis. Who needs tennis lessons when you have a tennis racket? A smart tennis racket. And that's the future of mobile computing. Right? It's the idea that all of our stuff can teach us. Bruce Sterling, science fiction author that I like a lot, wrote a book called Distraction. And in that book, one of the scenarios he had was a group of people built a hotel. And they received all the pieces for the hotel, a big pile. And the first piece said, start with me, start with me. And they started with this piece, and the piece told them where to put it. And then the next piece spoke out, Nelly, Nelly. And the hotel instructed them how to build the hotel. So they built a hotel by themselves with no training or education in how to do it. That's not impossible. We could do that now. So we don't need hotels out there. Here's a third one. Now, you've heard of badges, right? A badge is a piece of digital content that certifies that you've accomplished some objective. There's an initiative called Mozilla Backpack that allows you to store your badges and display your badges. So this has been built into technology like Mahara and WordPress and the like, so everyone can display their badges. Now, what's really interesting, a couple of things that are interesting about this. The first thing is, it's an instance of these micro-credentials. So you can get a badge for almost nothing, right? Walk up the stairs, you get a badge, walk up the stairs. Okay, maybe not that, but you know, doing pretty minor things. Secondly, anybody can issue a badge. So, not just colleges and universities. I could give you a badge. You think about that, right? Now, I know whether you're paying attention because I have my quantified self there, right? And at the end of the talk, if you paid attention for 80% of the talk, I could give you a badge, and that would be your certification. So now I'm competing directly with your educational institution. But the problem is, what if people just make them up? I could give you all a PhD. Or even worse, you can say I gave you a PhD. That's where blockchain comes in. Blockchain is a technology that is used for digital currencies, like Bitcoin. And the idea of a digital currency is that you engage in a transaction, you give a Bitcoin to someone else, and that transaction is recorded and encrypted, and then a series of these transactions are stored in encrypted form into what we call blocks. And everybody gets to see the block. So you can't change it after the fact, right? It's in the block, it's out there in the world. They don't know what it is, because it's encrypted, but if you try to change it, everybody will know. You can't change it. So that's what makes digital currency secure. It's a really interesting technology. One of these things, again, you're going to need to know about it. What's interesting is you can use this for anything, not just coins. You can use it for contracts. There's an organization called DAO that's using it for that. Or you can use it for credentials. The first time I saw this proposed was by Doug Belshaw a number of months ago. I also saw Audrey Waters write about it. And my fellow Canadian Don Tapscott has just written a book, and released a book, about blockchain, about digital currencies, and secure credentials. So this is a form, part of our learning landscape. Okay. Doesn't seem too frightening yet. We're getting there. Internet of Things. So this pulls together, I love the thunder in the background. So it all adds some drama to it. Thank you. Internet of Things, I don't know whether that's approval or disapproval. I think you all have a sense of what the Internet of Things is, but maybe not a sense of the scale of what could be the case. And maybe not a sense of what happens when this really takes off. So the idea of Internet of Things is everything, or at least a large number of things, has its own digital address, its own internet address, and can receive signals from the internet and send signals to the internet. That's the basic technology. So the first use of these was for sensor networks. So you set up a bunch of sensors and you put them all online, and these sensors can record if there's a flood or if there's a fire or if there's an earthquake. And so you don't need to have people out there checking the water. So that's a pretty good idea. Amazon has things now with an internet connection. You can push a button and order something from your cupboard. So you have a little tag hanging in your cupboard. You push a button on that tag, it orders soap. And the next morning, there's soap on your doorstep. And then the bill, on your credit card bill, because Amazon never forgets. What's interesting is these things will start talking to each other. Your car will be part of the Internet of Things, and your car will talk to other cars, not always nicely, but they try to get along. It'll be really interesting, though, when we have self-driving cars. Self-driving cars, they will be talking to each other. There'll be constant chatter in the background, and they will be negotiating how they drive with each other, which kind of makes sense. So you have cars talking to street signs and traffic lights. You have traffic lights responding to all the cars, and if you need to have a lot of flow in one direction, that sort of thing. So you can picture that for a traffic network. Can you picture that in your own home, where your appliances are talking to each other? Where the air conditioner turns off if the furnace turns on. Where the fridge turns on if the air conditioner turns off. Well, whatever, I don't know what things or houses are saying to each other. Okay. It's a little out there, but I like it. This one you're probably more familiar with, but it's going to be more significant and more important as time goes by. Games, simulations, and virtual reality. I've learned everything I know about how to fly a helicopter, which admittedly is not much, inside a simulation. I've learned tons about flying a helicopter. I would still not trust myself to do it, but I could. I could learn to fly a helicopter in a simulation. Doctors who are performing operations use simulations to practice the operation before they actually do the operation. Now, right now, this is technology that is, you know, for professionals, for experts, pilots, doctors, lawyers, to simulate the case, trial work, but eventually it would be for everybody. Now, you could simulate doing some carpentry before you do some carpentry, etc. Even more interesting are the immersive virtual reality systems, for example, the Oculus Rift, that puts you in the environment. Now, if you think about that, think about the competition between somebody teaching a course or being able to practice something in a virtual environment. This is a very powerful technology. Finally, translation, cooperative technology, conferencing, and all of the rest. This idea, I spent the whole day with the year. I was over there by the power. I spent an entire day in a Spanish-speaking conference, and I do not speak Spanish. So, in the future, this won't be a problem. In the future, I'll just put my earbuds in, and my phone will translate everything for me in real time. Why not? We're almost there now. We're almost to the point of real-time translation. So close. We have people at National Research Council working on it. It's a combination of two technologies, right? Speech recognition, and that's things like dragging, naturally speaking, and things like that. And then automated translation, like Google Translate, things like that. Combine those, you have real-time translation. The only thing we're waiting for is the computer power. So, the way I look at it, it would be easier to talk to somebody, to interact with them online. You know, we have life-size video, virtual, immersive virtual reality, real-time conferencing, all of the rest. In fact, it's easier to talk to them online than it would be to talk to them in person. Why would you talk to someone in person? You have to go there. They might speak a different language. They might use vocabulary you don't understand, so it'd be nice to have a little voice in the back of your head explaining what they mean. So somebody says, you know, friend and a friend, friend, and the little voice says, that's just some nonsense from the Wizard of Oz person. That'd be nice, right? It'd be so much easier to talk to somebody virtually than in person. Think about that. And this cooperation, as I mentioned before, includes machines as well. You'll talk to machines just as easily as you talk to people. Oh, sure, we will still type. Typing is great. And we'll draw with our hands and things like that. But we'll also speak to computers. That happens now. We will sub-vocalize to computers. And what I mean by that is, we will have a thought, this thought will be translated by a computer chip in our here. And that thought will then be sent by wireless signal to our mobile computer, and that will be a command sent to the computer. So I'll go like, and my computer will do something. Like, say, record my voice, or record your voice, or whatever. Okay, so these are some interesting technologies. Now things are going to get a little bit scary. Because let's take the trends that are happening in learning. Let's take some of these new technologies, and let's think about your jobs. Yes, your jobs. And think about what's going to happen to you. So I'm going to scare you. Well, let's think about learning content to begin with. Well, learning contents are already becoming open source, open content, free, widely shared. There's the Open Educational Resource Movement, there's the Creative Commons Movement. Even more to the point, people who are not experts are able to create content. Your learning content that you use in a course, assuming you're doing a course, which probably won't be, could easily have been created by a student who did the same course last year. If they learned the material, why not? And so they made the content, and then they shared the content. And in fact, the content's almost disposable. It gets remade every year by students. This whole idea of a professor sitting down and writing a textbook or building an open online course, no. Now, I'm known as a person who created the MOOC. The idea of the MOOC that we created was that we would not need to create any content for our MOOC, because all the content that we needed already existed as open educational resources. And more, we would take all the contributions by participants in our course, and we'd make those open educational resources as well. So I didn't have to make any content, because it's easy. It was a great way to teach a course. But even more, why does anyone need to create the content? About 3 days ago, the Associated Press, the United States News Agency, announced that it would use computer programs to write articles about minor league baseball. So, no more articles written by people. If you read a story about the Durham Bulls, which is a minor league baseball team, it was written by a computer. Not too long ago, there was a program called Jill Blue, I think it was, that was used to fool students in an online class. Jill acted as the tutor. Jill, of course, was a robot, or as they call them, a chatbot. So, and there are all kinds of initiatives now where computers are making music, computers drawing pictures better than I can draw, computers are writing poetry way better than I can write. And computers can write courses. Why not? And computers can write them faster than you. The grammar will always be perfect, and it will be right up to date, because it can write the same course every day, and it won't cost anything. And, you know, if we can do that, why would we write courses anyway? Why would we write content anyway? Let's just write the learning material for the specific person right now. Oops, I get too excited. Let's have the computer write the learning content for the person right now as they need it. In fact, my talk could be given by a computer that would be drawing from all of your feedback, your Facebook posts, your Twitter things, and then saying exactly what needs to be said at this moment that will be most important to you. not be able to tell. Computers, they can't do that yet. 10 years from now, it's not impossible that they could. Like I said, they're already writing source words. Okay? Well, there's still the classroom, right? I mean, you still need to go somewhere and help students, coach them, well, maybe not so much. We built the MOOC, the technology that I used to build our MOOC. I also used to create an online newspaper. So my online newspaper runs itself. I don't do anything. And this newspaper has a community around it. So there's people on Facebook, people on Twitter, people with blogs. They all live in the city of Moncton. The newspaper is called Moncton Free Press. I haven't looked at it for 2 months. It runs all by itself. Now imagine this. Well, I only connect to a bunch of things. I connect to the Canadian Weather Service for up-to-date weather reports. The Canadian Weather Service in turn connects to sensors. That's all automated. I connect to press offices, etc. I could, if I wanted, connect to Statistics Canada. I have right up-to-date unemployment statistics, commodity markets, all of that. My learning environment could have instant poll results. I gave a presentation once. The presentation, a long time ago, and it's going to happen. It'll be to teach people about national finance. Instead of giving them courses about the federal budget and things like that, you set up an environment called the Budget Simulator. You give everybody access to it. So each person can each person can create their own version of the federal budget. Everyone. You might think, well, how did they do that? Well, they have all the data. The system would be connected to the government revenue department, tax revenue, tariffs and royalties, policies. It could be connected to real-time expenses for different departments. If there's a cost overrun in that bridge, that would show up in your budget. So, and of course, it would do all the calculations for you, so you don't have to do that. Capital asset depreciation, all that kind of stuff. So it could do all this for you. And so you set up your budget, and other people set up their budgets. You connect to all these resources, then you connect to other services to argue for your budget. You connect to, say, an analytics service that's offered as analytics as a service by Microsoft, and you say, according to this analytics service, our revenue next year will be such and such. Now, that's pretty involved, right? But the idea here is that a person could learn everything about the budget by creating their own budget. But here's where it gets really fun. Why should this just be a simulation? Why not actually make it the budget, the national budget? You have everybody interested in the budget in the country doing research, using all this technology, doing the calculations, and your system could find what amounts to the consensus budget, the budget that represents the point of view of everybody using the system. And it would publish that every year. And it would say, the consensus budget is this. Well, what government's going to go against that? Right? It's not law. Right? Purely in an advisory capacity. But over time, no government would violate the consensus budget. So people in the community would actually be learning about national finance by actually writing the budget themselves. That's a learning environment. It's like neurosurgery. And on the left-hand side there, there's a neurosurgery tool. And on the right-hand side, you see the person actually using it. Well, from a certain perspective, if the simulation is good enough, that person doesn't know whether or not they're actually operating on a human brain. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. Over time, your neurosurgery tool can use the collective contributions of a bunch of people using the simulation to actually perform neurosurgery. Why not? That's a better way to learn neurosurgery than sitting in a classroom listening to a lecture. So, we don't really need these classrooms. We don't even need these labs. Eventually, we won't even need these computer labs because everybody will have their own technologies, just like everyone has their phone. So you don't need to do that either. So what about assessment and recognition? I talked about earlier how bad tests are. I talked about how people don't trust them anymore. I also talked about competencies and micro-credentials and degree, things like that. But if you stop and think about it, we don't need any of that. What if the evidence of our learning was actually evidence? The stuff we do, the things we say. What if everything we did was part of our assessment? I mean, we've got personal devices that monitor everything we write, where we go, connected self, right? Everything that we've done, we can put into a computer system. And we can have a computer system look at what an actual expert does, because they're connected, right? So you take the best surgeon in the world, everything that that person does and says, and compare it to what you do. It takes a lot of computing power, but you can do it. That will tell you how far away you are from being a neurosurgeon. In my case, pretty far. Not as far as you might think, though. I tried that simulation. That was pretty good. Right? Who needs assessment? In fact, who needs credentials at all? Because if I'm operating a company, or if I'm the manager of Monster.com, which finds people jobs, what I want to do is I want to match a person to a job. Well, I'm not going to depend on... Oh, the protesters are here. There's always protesters at the end of my talk. It's okay. So, I just want somebody to know my job, right? If I know what that job entails, I can take that job and this person's actual evidence and just match them to the job. So instead of getting grades, instead of getting certificates, you get job offers. Or employment contract offers. The more you know, the better the job. If it turns out that, according to the system, you can do neurosurgery, you will now get offers to perform neurosurgery on you. Take them out, whatever you want. We don't need all the rest of that. So, for those of you who spend any amount of time marking tests, or essays, or assignments, I remember when I was a professor, the foot of marking. That's how I measured my marking, in linear feet. We won't have to do that anymore. So on the one hand, yay, but on the other hand, what are we going to do with ourselves? So, what is your job going to be? I hope you're scared. Better be scared. Think about it. There's three things, typically, that we think of when we think of the role of faculty. There's, you know, the expert, the giver of content, the person who knows things and tells people, shows them how to do it. We don't need that anymore. We've got computers who can do it better than people. There's the coach, the mentor, the person who helps them out, the person who develops a personal relationship with the student, supports them. Well, the computer is going to know these students far better than any professor. Way better. The assessment? No. No, and all the things that we think that an instructor does, getting them engaged, getting them immersed, we don't need to do that anymore. Because students now are designing their own courses, they're working in environments that pose them real, authentic problems, problems that matter, like the budget of a country. How are you going to compete with that? So, what are you going to do? What's left of your job? No teaching, no coaching, no learning. What's your role now? Well, think about it. None of this is happening in a vacuum, right? Think about your own learning for a moment. Think about how you learn, how you keep up with your job. This conference is just part of it. Sitting here listening to me is just part of it, but it's a small part, right? Mostly you speak to friends, you look things up on Google, you try stuff, you get a new piece of software on your computer. If you're a digital native or anything like that, you don't read the manual, you don't take a class, you just start pushing buttons and see what happens. That's how I learn software. You know, and you think about when and where you need learning. If you're standing in front of a class, you can't stop and take a course if you don't know something. Right? You need help right away. Where does that help come from? You have a little manual right there, you have a guide, you have someone you can ask. Ask the student in the back who always knows about the text. In the future, for you, as well as for everyone else, learning will be like water, like electricity, like text. It'll be there. And that's how you will learn. So, okay. Let's think about what learning is in this environment. This is a bit of a caricature, but to learn is to practice and reflect. Sometimes you need support, and you can talk to your friend, or you can talk to your artificial intelligence. Sometimes you need answers. Usually you just need some examples, you know, here's how it's done properly, and then you start practicing, you do it, that's how you learn. That's how the brain works, right? That's how you learn the language, you use the language. That's how you learn to play darts, you play darts. That's how you learn to fly an airplane, you fly an airplane. To learn is to practice and reflect. That's how you learn. And you know that. And this is the point. You know that. Why? Because you've reflected on your own learning. Okay, good. What is it then to teach? To teach is to model and demonstrate. Like I said, that's what you need as a learner, right? To give an example, to show how it's done. How do you learn how to play darts? You watch Jockey Wilson play darts. How do you learn brain surgery? You stand there and you watch some guy do brain surgery, and then of course you try it yourself, hopefully on a simulator. to teach is to model and demonstrate. The showing of how something is done, but not just that, by making open the thinking, making open the thought process. That's the actual modeling. Now, if I had another hour, I could go into a long talk about this is how science today actually works. It's not form a hypothesis and make predictions. It's about modeling. It's about trying things out. It's about finding the best fit. And that's your job as an instructor. Show people how you try. Show people how you fail. I fail a lot. And when I fail, I put it in my blog. Because people need to see that this stuff is hard. So, the new institutional perspective. You as a professional, you are no longer doing things to students. You're on their side now. You're offering support. You're helping people. The winner in the new economy isn't the person who took the most out of it. It's the person who put the most into it. You are in the business of sharing your knowledge by showing, by modeling, by demonstrating, by actually doing the work. You're not teaching anymore. You're doing, and you're doing openly. And it's not just, you know, the carpentry or the quantum physics or whatever. It's what you go through as a learner, because what you've done that your students haven't done is you've learned and you've learned and you've learned. Every 5 years, everything changes. And you've learned, you become a master of it. And that's what you're showing. And we don't know what people are going to need to know 5 years from now, but if you're a good learner and you show that, then you're preparing your students how to figure out what they need 5 years from now. So new model of work and learning. Kind of broken down into these three elements. Sharing. Sharing everything you do. I'm recording my talk. I really hope there's video. I get a text transcript of it. I'm sharing this experience. There will be photos. There's always photos. If I fell off the stage, there would be photos. But not just that, contributing to their work, their tasks, offering scaffolds, mechanisms, simulations, etc., and helping them when they ask for help. And then finally, not being a part of them, but being part of the team. You working with them as equals, co-creating. You contributing your budget. You doing your neurosurgery so people can watch. You flying your airplane. You figuring out your quantum physics or whatever. Doing that openly. Learning and sharing your struggles and all together working on these common problems, these common social projects and social tasks. That's everything I got. Thank you very much for being here.
Agradecemos por su conferencia, Steven Downs, y le pedimos permanecer un minuto para recibir el reconocimiento de manera de Joaquín Guerra.
Maybe this can become virtual later on. Gracias.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Cool.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, get off the stage. Okay.
Pedimos a continuación a Rafael de los Santos, presidente del Consejo del Instituto de Emprendimiento.
Well done. Keep an eye on your things.
That's the recording.